I'm going to make these relationships, whatnot. They might be in mainstream pop music. They might be in Christian music. But who it ultimately goes to is I give that to God. I give that the destiny of that to God. And I'm not going to necessarily try to get all of that figured out. And that has been, that's just been swimming against a 60-foot wave my entire life.
How can the seemingly insignificant details of life unveil profound insights on love, creativity, and faith? Today on Seek, Go, Create, we're honored to host Charlie Peacock, a multi-Grammy winner, and author Andy Ashworth, as they share the wisdom gleaned from nearly 50 years of marriage in their latest book, Why Everything That Doesn't Matter, Matters So Much. This couple brings to life the notion that every aspect of our existence, no matter how small, has the potential to impact people, the planet, and culture. Through a collection of letters, they offer hope and practical advice to Christians seeking to navigate the complexities of the modern world with kindness, forgiveness, and hospitality. Welcome to Seek, Go, Create.
For that wonderful introduction.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to say right out, I usually start off with this odd question about what people do. But I have thoroughly enjoyed over the last few days, I feel as if I've gotten to know you through your book. And I want to say this might be a good thing, might not. I didn't know much about you before that. It's really been quite intriguing for me that this is kind of my introduction, which is really cool. But I think what I'd love to do, I usually kind of get people to talk about what they do or things like that, but it's rare that I have couples. So what I'd love to do, and maybe start with you, Andy, I'd love for maybe you to intro or say something about Charlie. And then Charlie, if you could say something or intro Andy, and then we'll kind of get rolling and see where things take us. So
sure.
Andy, introduce Charlie to me.
Okay, I will. I will start with Charlie has been my boyfriend since I was 15 years old. And the first thing he ever did was sit me down in his room and have me listen to Miles Davis, an important Miles Davis record, and to tell me that this was really important to him. Music was really important to him. And he's an extraordinary musician and songwriter and record producer. And he's a really beautiful, encouraging husband, and a really fun grandfather, and a very fun dad. And in the world of things that he makes a lot of fun, memorable things happen in our family. So I would start with that.
That is an excellent introduction. Charlie, can you, how about that?
I don't know if I can match that. Yes, this is Andy, and as she said, my sweetheart since I was a teenager, and we have created a life together that is completely unexpected, not planned for, and yet in many ways planned for since we were kids. I mean, we can go back and look at things that we journaled or something that we may have made it a sort of vision board or something in high school and see so many things that came to pass. And a big part of that is that Andy is the glue in our relationship and in our family because she puts relationships first. And in my work, I've had this weird mix of relational and transactional. And there's just not a transactional bone in Andy's body. It's like all love, all people, all the time, and always concerned about what someone is thinking or feeling and how she can serve them and bring them in closer. And so she does that with me. I mean, she does that with our kids and our grandkids. And it really is that we really are first on her mind. And then out from there, she has extraordinary friendships. I mean, she has friendships with girlfriends from before we were together. So that's how much she is this kind of sticky, glue-centered, relational person, that she makes a friend and she keeps a friend. And that's a really beautiful thing. And then she just has a huge, hospitable heart that is a welcoming heart and creates spaces for people that are deeply meaningful for them, for strangers and for people that she's known ever. I mean, that's just the tip of it, but that's a good introduction.
I appreciate those words. And like, I think we're in a society and culture where, number one, longevity, almost 50 years of marriage. My wife and I just celebrated 35, so we're a number of years behind, but heading in that direction. And
yeah, mm-hmm. Doing well.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And I think very similar to the two of you, we're still in learning mode. I mean, do y'all feel like, mm-hmm. I don't want to say you're just getting started, but I mean, is it, where are you at in the spectrum?
Yeah, we're just getting started on our fifth marriage.
To each other.
Yeah, each other. Yeah, I mean, Andy said it well at different times that they're just these big phases, and we are very grateful to be in a really good one right now, mm-hmm. where we have gone through a valley where we had to learn a lot again and come out of it. And yeah, we know that now. I think that the certainty of our love and our marriage has never been greater because of many valleys and mountaintops that we've traversed together.
One thing that's interesting to me, I had a conversation recently with a guest, and he was talking about that the goal isn't really balance. He was talking about being a business leader, and he says, we're not to lead a balanced life. We're really called to lead an integrated life where we integrate our faith. Mm-hmm. And we hear this, yeah. We hear things thrown around in our culture, society, things like opposites attract. And I don't know that I agree with that. I believe that with my wife and I, and kind of what I'm hearing with you two and reading, is I think that complements attract. It's like people that are complementary that can integrate. And to me, it seems as if one of our journeys in this married life is learning how to integrate, and we're still mm-hmm. learning. It sounds like y'all are still learning. Now, the thing that, let me go ahead and dive right into the book, because I think it's going to lead us in a lot of different directions. The book, Why Everything That Doesn't Matter Matters So Much. And the thing that I kept getting from it was how well y'all integrated. I think I saw plenty of places that there could be conflict, because when you have a certain personality and a certain personality, but I kept seeing integration, and I was wondering if that was one of the intentions of the book, or is it a byproduct, or have y'all even thought about it? That Andy, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's both. I think it's maybe something we don't even realize all the time, but we do tend to be of one mind about a lot of things. And then we also definitely have our own personalities. And I agree with the person you were referring to. I don't think the balance is a possible thing. I think there is grace and there is tension along the way of our life. I just think that's the real thing. I think there's, you know, lots of tension for lots of reasons, whether age or stage or personalities but then there's grace inside of that. And that is, I think, the journey, the pilgrim journey is to, I don't know, I always see it as putting your palms open at really difficult passages and saying, I don't know how to move forward. help us, guide us. We're really needy. And then we'll integrate again, even if we've been far apart. I think we get closer and closer and closer together. The more we age, the more we experience. And yeah, so it's been all of that.
Yeah, one.
And the book.
Let's take a short break from the show. Think about the leader you are today and the leader you want to become. Hello, I'm Tim Wenders, your guide to personal and professional transformation. In my executive coaching sessions, we dive deep into what it means to be a truly impactful leader, one who leads not just with skills, but with vision and faith. Through my coaching, leaders have redefined their approach, achieving not just success, but also purpose and joy in their work. Are you ready for this kind of transformation? Let's explore your potential together. Schedule your free discovery coaching call at timwenders.com/coaching. Your leadership journey is just beginning. Now back to Seek, Go, Create.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, Charlie, one of the things that was intriguing to me, it actually wasn't intriguing. It was more affirming. That's maybe the better word. Was one of the last chapters that you wrote. And I don't want to say it was almost like an apology. I think you even worded it more of a confession of these are some mm-hmm. things that I've done that as a multitasker, you use the word multitasking, and as someone who is more transactional and someone who is more maybe in the business space, I don't think I'm putting words in my mouth. It was almost like you were sort of as a husband, father saying, I'm sorry that I was this way. I wish I could change it a little bit. And I think that relates to the tension or the integration, whatever that we feel as people that are leaders. You want to, what can you say to that? Did I read it right? Or was I projecting my issues onto what you were writing?
Yeah, I think you did read it right. No, I think you did read it right. I think there's I'm not one of these people who thinks that you should go through life without regrets. I actually think that if you don't have regrets, then you've got probably a serious ego problem or a problem with the self-analysis, you know. So I'm okay with having regrets. But I put them in, I hope, perspective in knowing that all my efforts, all my best efforts are proximate efforts. I haven't done anything with perfection. The reason for the analysis or the reason for the confession is simply to grow in grace and to receive grace for that and to continue to mature and not look at just my age number and say, oh, well, yeah, I'm pretty much done now. It's more like as I feel that God reveals things to me, then I do want to mature and grow. And so a lot of the things that worked for me in business, it's kind of like they had a two sides of the coin. There was a positive side and a negative side. And so you could so easily tip over, just flip the coin, and then it's all negative, right? So you take things like a really unusual resilience, perhaps, right? Or the ability to work long hours or any of those kinds of things, right? Then you think, well, look, I don't, an 8-hour day, I mean, shoot, let's do a 16-hour day. I mean, look how much more we can get done, right? But that's based on the object of just getting things done, right? And there are many things in life for entrepreneurial people where, yeah, that is job one, getting it done and getting it done well and getting it done for the least amount of expense and the quickest amount of time, right? So you can become so oriented by that way of thinking that you'll miss the people that you love the most and miss moments in life that you'll later regret. You'll think like, well, did I really have to do that? I mean, and this is where Andy has been such a good voice through our entire marriage to just insert the Sabbath theology of dependence and rest into day-to-day living where we can hold to this idea that we're just small little people, right? We do get these extraordinary opportunities to do really big things. And some of us are super excited about that, and we enter into it, and we execute it and do that. But at the end of the day, what I learned was that I did a lot of that stuff based on the wrong motivations. And so most of my maturity and healing has come through discovering why I was so motivated. Certainly a part of it is taking care of a family, building businesses and all of that. I get that. But there's also a part where it becomes your meaning. And for me, I mean, I was in a sense addicted to imagining and addicted to creating, because that's where I felt the safest, the ability to just immerse myself in my imagination and draw out of that things that I wanted to bring into the world. And that just made me feel safe. And when it came time for the world to decide whether it was going to applaud me and pay me for it, they made the decision to applaud me and pay me, right? Which, of course, what did that do? That just reinforced it, right? And so I lived on that for a long, long time while trying to be a good husband, good father, good grandfather, all of that. But I did have to finally come to terms with the fact that this was that two-sided coin, and that there was a super positive contribution to culture, to family, to all of that, but that all it took was just a little flip and it could go to the negative side of it.
The interesting thing about that is that I recognized, I've always, business has always been my quote unquote, I guess, arena, maybe my art. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that. What's cool about this conversation is I've never considered myself someone who is an artist, even though in the last few years I've written a novel, which was quite an interesting stretch for me. It's very fascinating. We could kind of sidebar that. But related to what you were saying there, Charlie, what I recognize with me a while back, and I'm still working through this, is that I had an addiction to more. And I spoke to someone recently that said it was a related addiction, but they were addicted to tomorrow. And I've never heard someone say they're addicted to imagination. And I don't think that those are the same, but I think they're related. And I think they could spin off in different directions. I think the challenge with our culture and our world, and I might even let Andy address this and speak to this, is that often that is rewarded and applauded and celebrated, as opposed to if you and I had been addicted to, I don't know, alcohol or meth or something like that, we would obviously have issues there. But we're applauded because it looks as if we're succeeding. But I'm not sure that we are in the eternal. I think we are.
Yeah.
But we're not.
You're succeeding by a standard. It's just not an eternal standard.
Well, and so what does that do for someone in your role, Andy, when you're attached or integrated or married to or cleaning up the messes or whatever you want to say about someone who is that way? Because my wife, we could probably get you all here and y'all could have this conversation. But what's that like?
Well, it's different at different stages of life. I'm thinking of when we were younger parents, and we had just moved to Nashville, and the music business, the music making, recording, touring, record companies began to have a more and more say in how our life was lived. But I didn't really get any say. But it was all coming from, it was coming from outside of us, and I didn't have a chance to respond much. So the way I was responding is that I'm trying to hold up a flag for somebody to see, to say, I'm starting to drown here. I need, and then it moved into the realm of the hospitality thing, where we had a very, very open home for more than two decades. And so everything was happening inside of the home. In that regard, where I was, whether it was taking care of children, oftentimes on my own for that, or whether it was later in life, taking care of guests and house guests and the people who were coming through, which was all something that I felt very called to and loved. But then there was a place where I also wanted to say, but I don't want to be alone in these things. I want a partner. And I don't think that biblically it's meant to be that way either. So that was often a big struggle for me. And now we're at a different stage of life. So we don't have guests in our house all the time as we used to. Our children are grown. We have a lot more choice, and we have come to a much better understanding of each other and what's good for each other and how we want to live. It's so much better in that regard, where both of our voices are heard. But I will say that in those other things that I just talked about, that made them, it had the joyful part and the called part, and then the part that I thought, I don't want to be alone in these things all the time, and I want to have choice and I want to have a say. But as Chuck already said, especially with the music business, or with record companies, it's always like every opportunity is the right opportunity, right? But that might not always be the case for a marriage or a family or.
Charlie, one of the things, I love in the book, and I was afraid I would call him Chuck because you call him Chuck throughout the book.
Yeah, no, you can call me Chuck.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
So, Charlie or Chuck. Or whoever, he'll answer.
Yeah.
I'll answer anything.
Well, I'll tell you how it breaks down. It's like if my parents, I think in the last days, my dad would call me Charlie just for fun, I think. My mom still always called me Chuck, and then Andy called me Chuck. Because I didn't start being Charlie till I was about 21 or so, I guess. So I have like people that, in fact, I just got an email from someone yesterday, right? And so they said, "Dear Chuck," right? Because they qualified, like they've been around so long. They qualify to be in the Chuck years, right? But you do whatever you want.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, good. Well, something that I enjoyed. So here's another bit of confession for me. My personality would be one where I would really enjoy the content of Charlie's letters that he wrote in the book, because generally they had a flavor of some business and some things that were going on and all of that. And I'm hopeful that Charlie, this is when you might say, I want you to call me Charlie, not Chuck, that Charlie's okay with this. Mm-hmm. But I found myself truly enjoying Andy's letters. I felt as if I was sitting with her and talking with her,
mm-hmm.
where with Charlie, I was gathering information that I loved. I also want to say this about the book, and this is, I think, probably one of the best endorsements that I could give. My wife and our readers, I read a lot, obviously, to consume content, to do research for the podcast. Mm-hmm. And my wife, almost every book she reads, she tells me, you need to read this book. You need to read this book. You need to read this book. I rarely will read a book and say to her, my wife's Glory, oh, you need to read this book. I was about halfway through over the weekend, and I said, this is a book you need to read. There's a lot of things that can touch you. There's a lot of things to pull from, things like that. So having said all that, Charlie, I'm about to ask you about one of the letters that you wrote that really pulled at me as far as the topic. And that is this whole aspect of putting the label Christian in front of whatever. I deal with it because anything. I'm a businessman, and I always, you're a Christian businessman. I said, well, I don't even like the word Christian much anymore. I mean, I notice y'all use this term follower of Jesus or follower of Christ. I try to use that too. And I'm almost I don't think I'm trying to distance myself from people. Maybe I am. We don't have to get into that.
Mm-hmm.
But talk a little bit about the industry you've been in, that label that you really, in that early on letter in the book, I won't say you were ranting, but I said, he's trying to get a point across here.
Very much so. I mean, and it's, I will say that as much as I don't want it to be, I mean, it's been one of the kind of keystone works of my lifetime since I've been a young Christian. I mean, I have been in this conversation, writing about it, speaking about it, and I can't tell you how difficult it is to get this point across or to get anyone to understand it or receive it. That, and my retort to that is that reveals just how much the church is indoctrinated to branding as a way of being and a way of life. And what I've tried to say is that, no, you're free from that. And you can distinguish. I saw this with the Gospel Music Association back when I was involved with Christian music quite a bit. They really jumped on the branding bandwagon 25 plus years ago when people were hiring consultants right and left about everything had to be branded, right? Everything had to have elevator pitch, mission statement. I mean, everybody was in it. I don't care. You're going to start a business tomorrow. That was going to be the first thing you did, right? It wasn't about big ideas anymore. It wasn't about passion. It wasn't about instinct, intuition. It wasn't about risk anymore. All of those things followed after you got your branding together. And I saw that infiltrate the church in every aspect of it. Pastors became brand. I mean, everything, and then all the products that were associated with it. And I just was like, man, you guys, you just don't know where this leads. It leads to narrowing our concepts of what it means to be a Christian. It doesn't widen them. Like the whole purpose, the whole economic purpose of branding is to have the least amount of conversation to produce the highest effect. Right? If I say water, your mind can immediately go to the options, right? I mean, it is the simplest conversation. That's why water was chosen as something that was so simple to sell and so simple to brand, right? And something that you can make an extraordinary amount of money on. I mean, any of us who have been entrepreneurs, we would have been lucky to just be water salespeople, right? I mean, it's so simple. And that's exactly what branding seeks to do. It seeks to simplify everything. And the point about being a Jesus follower is that it is not simple. It is not simple. It is so complex, and it's so individual, and it has so many different missions, so many different looks. Not only that, it's generation. And it's international. And I mean, it's so the ability, the idea that we would brand something as Christian, it's like, what Christian? Who's Christian? Well, I'm going to need more information than that. And it's so, especially now, that's why I would take that position, is because, look, if you call me a Christian, I want to know what you mean by that. If I call something a Christian, you should want to know what I mean by that. Because if anyone who studies it for even 5 minutes is going to find out that there are so many ideas about what constitutes a Christian today that we are not speaking the same language. Mm. We are just absolutely not speaking the same language.
I think what bothers me, I mean, again, I'm a business guy, is kind of all, most of what I've done. That's where all my successes and addictions and challenges have been related to.
Sure.
And, you know, the mantra there, like you said, with branding, I'll say it maybe a slightly different way, is you have to know your audience. You have to choose your audience. You have to mm-hmm. focus on your audience, isolate your audience, and speak directly to your audience. And
absolutely,
what that gets us is, I think what it gets us is the culture we have today, where we have an extreme tribal, and again, we I don't want us to go down this path, but we're extremely tribal, confusing, isolated group of people at a time where we should be more connected than ever because we could do things like we're doing right here. Three people meet, get on a technology platform and have a 1 hour conversation and share it with the world. How cool is that? And
yeah, amazing.
And so I think back to it when I was reading through that chapter, it reminded me of years ago. I started following Tim Tebow on Instagram, and I was following him because I was attempting to identify kind of how to call myself. I mean, I'm a coach at heart, but I love doing this and I love doing a lot of things, and I've written a novel. How interesting is that?
Yeah.
And I wanted to say, do I need to put Christian businessman, Christian coach? Because I see that. And I went to Tim Tebow's, who we all know Tim's background and stuff like that. And at that time he had athlete. That was his description. So it is more of that what one does or their gift. And and I think it's part of what's causing our issues today is that we're attempting to, I'll say it this way and then I'll be quiet. Maybe I'll let Andy respond to this. I really believe we're attempting to use Babylonian principles to describe kingdom of God, people, and what we're trying to do. I mean, we're just trying to do all the stuff that the world system says when we really should be operating out of what y'all's book says, the way of love in a world of hurt. So anyway, there wasn't a question there. Anything you want to say to it, either one of you?
No, but you nailed it. You nailed it exactly. I mean, I wish more people would understand what it was that you were saying, but you did nail it. I mean, that's exactly what it is. It's Babylonian principles.
Yeah.
Inserting kingdom language. So you're devaluing the language because it's actually the kingdom language is inflated or informed by all this Babylonian impulse, right? And so it's really not, the words don't mean what we think they mean.
Right, right, yeah.
They're placeholders for a different kind of affection. And I think that's the reason why we try to be as careful as we can to define what we're talking about. Try to write in such a way and speak in public in such a way that people can look over our shoulder or anyone can be in the room. I will say this, and then I'll pass off to Andy, is that I do think that there can be a place for someone to say, I'm a Christian life coach, okay, if you want to. If you want your audience to only be Christians. And that's it. So like when my really, really close friends that I worked with for years at EMI Christian Music Group or Sparrow Records or any of those folks, when they self-identify as a Christian business person or self-identify as a Christian record company, they want to do that because they do want to sell things to Christians. The difference between them and I is that I was never driven to sell things to Christians exclusively. And I've never been driven that way. I'm so much more on the making side. And my drivenness is on the making. And then I sort of draw a line in the dirt and say, and now who it goes to, of course, I'm going to make these relationships, whatnot. They might be in mainstream pop music. They might be in Christian music. But who it ultimately goes to is I give that to God. I give that the destiny of that to God. And I'm not going to necessarily try to get all of that figured out. And that's just been swimming against a 60-foot wave my entire life. But I do believe for me, that's my calling, and so I have to stick with it. I mean, that's what faithfulness looks like for me. I'm not saying it has to be that way for you, but I'm saying that's what it looks like for me. So I do want to be understood. Maybe that's why I keep writing about it. I want to please someone understand this.
Or you want to convince someone. I think that's sometimes what I'm trying to do is convince people to be more, I don't know if it's more open. I mean, I'm sure you have seen these situations if you've been around the industry. There are times that I would much rather hang out, I hate to say it this way, with heathens than with people that call themselves Christians. And I think this is, I'm going to lob it over to Andy here. I think that that is kind of the root of this hospitality gift that people have. I don't think that one can be hospitable and be discriminatory. To me, it doesn't seem that way. I mean, I guess we could be maybe choosy, but and it seems as if, and my wife has that gift too, that this hospitality has been a gift that you've had. You even talk about food in the book in a way. I'm going, this is one of the things I'm saying, my wife's going to love this. I'm going, she just talked about soup in a most beautiful, descriptive way that I've never heard anyone talk about soup. So anyway, talk about hospitality, Andy, and why it's important and why it fits into this conversation.
Okay. Well, I love what you said about it because I think you really hit the nail on the head. Hospitality is a way of being. So that's where it starts. It's not, I mean, it is a practice, and the practice can have so many different kinds of looks depending on who you are and what your situation is and what your the fullness of your gifts are, all of that. So no cookie cutter stuff here. And no, I mean, it is a way of being that is throughout the scriptures as a way of life, to be hospitable to strangers and to just to all kinds of people. So it starts as a welcoming presence, I guess. And so that is not discriminatory. That is not narrow. It's not, I have to know who you are and the fullness of your story before I can sit and have a meal with you or a cup of coffee or take a walk. Or it's more of, I actually want to know who you are, and I'd like to share myself with you. And I think that is, and then there are obviously the feeding and the sheltering parts of hospitality that are really important, central to who we are, any of us, in some way. So there is that part that there is something real and in the moment and in on the earth and meeting needs of people in these different ways. But I think the very beginning is that place of where we start. And that is like, I want to know you, or I want to be open to knowing you. I want to look at you and I want to see another human being. And I want to see all these things that we have in common, and which is our humanity and our needs and our vulnerabilities. And some of the greatest times that I can think of are even in our previous life or our life now, is just as to be with people at a table or over a cup of coffee and not have to have everything figured out about, you know, who you are. I don't have to sign off to you. You don't have to sign off to me. I'm just interested in who you are. And it's a gift if the interest is returned, then we can actually have a conversation together. And that's just a really beautiful way to be a human being. And I think you're right in that when we discriminate and say we have to check off boxes before we can be hospitable to somebody, it's such a wrong starting place. It just doesn't have any place, even with that word, I don't think.
There's no biblical precedent.
The thing that I kept, this kind of came to my mind a number of times, primarily when I was reading some of the letters that you wrote, Andy, was I kept getting a visual of Jesus with the woman at the well. And one of the things, I've talked to my wife about this, I've tried to repent and all that. My voice can come across with a very know-it-all tone. And I have to attempt to soften it, or someone might think, this guy thinks he knows it all, even though I don't think that I do, but maybe I do. Maybe there's some issues there. But I keep reminding myself of that woman at the well. And I even use things like, I really wish we would use more what I call woman at the well language. And I kept thinking about it in the book, because to me, I kept hearing woman at the well language, because if we look at the business world, we don't often get it there. If we look at a lot of relationships, husband, wives, I see some talk to people, I'm going, wow, is this your partner? This is, and we see it in the political arena and some of our leaders and things like that. So is that a good representation that one of the things you're sharing is how Jesus, who if people know the background of the woman at the well and the story, there was every reason for there to be discrimination there, but yet we saw none. Is that a good thing, right, for me to think of, mm-hmm, when I'm reading through your letters?
I think so. Yeah. I like that.
So that leads to...
Will you give me a drink? Yeah.
And the stages, I mean, it's almost like an outline of the stages of relationship. So you go from the simplicity of, can I have a drink, to I see you. I see the deepest part of you.
Right. So one of the things that was intriguing, I think I told y'all early on that I didn't know a lot about you, but I got to know you from reading this book. And there were a number of things that were intriguing that I obviously would love to ask more about. But the one thing that I want to do, and I'll let either one of you or both of you tell this, and that is the art house. I saw it early on in the book, and then it unfolded a little bit more what it was. And then later I got more of a description of it. But I guess, Andy, if you can start, tell me what the art house was and is, and then maybe Charlie, if you want to chime in after she's done, just because to me, I think it speaks to a lot of who the two of you are, as much as almost anything, is this concept of the art house and what it was.
All right. I'm going to try to make a long story much shorter and say that the art house began with an idea of a place to gather. And in the beginning, it was more specifically for artists to gather for fellowship, teaching, and hospitality, and to really connect the dots between biblical faith and daily life and vocation with a more artist-centric focus. And then that grew. So it was a place, and it began with an old Methodist church that was built in 1912. And we bought that place. It was down the street from our house. We had, we were a young family at the time, pretty new to Nashville. And this idea, this longing, this thing that was beginning to take shape had taken shape in Chuck's journals and in his mind and in his heart. And he was feeling called and propelled toward this thing that was kind of difficult to explain, but was growing. And he was trying to explain it to me. And I was kind of like, I'm not sure. But, and then a place became available. And we had this kind of wonderful, kind of miraculous, but really great story, which we probably don't have time to tell it. But there was this old church, it was down the street from our house. We bought it. And then we started hosting gatherings there. And all kinds of people came, from students at Belmont and Vanderbilt University, older people. And it grew from being a place that was just for artists to being a place where lots of people wanted to come for different kinds of gatherings and to hear different authors and speakers and theologians and musicians and filmmakers. Yeah. So then that was the beginning. But then 3 years after beginning this work, we moved our family into this place. And
we consolidated. We had a separate recording studio. We had a separate home. And we consolidated everything on this one property so that we were living there and the recording studios were there and the gathering place for people to come.
And family life. And so we were renovating all the time. That's what I was trying to say. So creating this beautiful place, and I was planting gardens and we were feeding people, but we were living there. We were raising our family. We were making records, or Chuck was making records. And there was the business part of our life, and everything was all together. But hospitality, this welcome, was at the center of it all, no matter what else was being done or created. Hospitality was the center. We're welcoming you into our home, into our studio. So that was like very core value. And then we ended up living almost 25 years in this place. And so it grew from just a place to gather to being a place where we had a lot of house guests and dinner guests and studio guests coming inside to have lunch and just all these different things that you could not set out to really know that's what you were creating in the beginning, but that's what it became as God was leading us. And now, so it kind of became this movement, and then some people took this and started an art house in Dallas, and that was the Reeves family. And so there's an art house Dallas, and they just have served Dallas. And so the central thing is creativity for the common good. That's the little tagline. And they do all kinds of things, all kinds of programs, and serve their city in lots of different ways. And then in Art House North is in St. Paul, Minnesota. And that is run by Sarah Groves and her husband, Troy Groves. And they are in an old church that they have created, an Art House North. And they do all kinds of hosting and gathering and
That's great. That's great. Yeah, like Art House Dallas is, they have a building, but they're more of a pop-up model. So they use a lot of different facilities. And we're talking like highly organized, the whole Dallas area, the DFW area. I mean, I think they had over 150 events last year. And yet Art House North in St. Paul is a little more like the way Art House in Nashville was when Andy and I were running it. But they do like theatrical productions. I mean, they have partnerships in the community for a lot of different regions. They do specific artist care. I mean, they have square dances, which is really cool.
Songwriters
workshops. Yeah. Yeah, it's quite extensive.
The reason that's fascinating on multiple levels for me, and one of the things that I've been saying for some time in the role that I'm in, is that the closest thing I have seen to what I believe that the early church was, and I want to make sure I word it that way so it doesn't come across that I think I know what I'm talking about, because I don't think I do, but my observations. As I've traveled and worked with companies and startups and things like that, I've observed that coffee shop culture, startup, and co-working spaces, to me, seem to have the vibe that I read about through my eyes in the book of Acts.
Mm-hmm.
And to contrast that somewhat frustrates me when I go into the way most churches are structured in our culture today. And I also have to say to you guys, the people listening know, I wasn't saved in a church. I was saved in a business setting. So my paradigm is a bit different than people. I'm not sure that a church setting would have done it. I think I read, Charlie, where a saxophonist, which that's got to be a cool story we don't have time for, where someone who was a saxophonist helped you meet Jesus, which, wow, that's cool. But
yeah, absolutely.
But to me, and I don't know if this was intentional or if it just formed up the way it did, the art house sounds a lot like the church of the book of Acts. Is that correct?
Mm. Yeah, I think so. I think there's people that it's like, if you're going to have a house church, you got to have somebody who's got the house that's going to be like, well, your house is perfect for this, right? And that person's got to be willing. The person's got to be willing to do that, right? And so, there's that just in terms of the infrastructure and the place. And is this for us, we wanted to have a place that had some built-in magnetism and sort of could speak without us speaking, so that it would say, come in, be welcome. Which, as we know, that's what good architecture does, and good groundskeeping and beautiful gardens and all of that. You step onto a property like that and feel like, oh, people tend to this. And there's already, I just got out of my car and I've already been hit with this wind of intentionality, right? So maybe I'll be tended to. Maybe I'll be cared for if I keep walking the walk up to the door, see what happens when the door opens. We played with that. That was very intentional, and all the art houses do that. They all have that kind of aesthetic, and yeah, with an emphasis on that. We have, because we've been in the arts and faith intersection for so long, we've had the opportunity to speak in all kinds of places with all kinds of people. And I remember decades ago, Andy and I having this revelation together about, we were at this place speaking on imagination and creativity, right? In the single most unimaginative, uncreative environment possible, right? With so little attention paid to the people who were coming to it, who had put down their whatever $35 for the weekend, and we just thought, we'll never do that. We'll go broke if we have to in order to not do that. But that, it's like, we're not going to say we profess to believe something and then create the contradiction. So that was just such a good lesson for us, that it's not about having a lot of money. It's really not. I've been saying on a lot of these podcasts that we've done, when people have talked to me about imagination and creativity, I've said, like, one of the most radical things that you can do in creating is creating a mood. It's just setting the stage for good to happen. The way you're greeted, are you greeted hopefully? Are you greeted by being known? We're grateful to you that you read our book. Right?
Really,
so
grateful.
That speaks to us, right? That speaks to us that we have been known in some way. And so that prepares our hearts more to be open to you. And that's just the exchange of the way we humans work best together. And when we don't have that, that's when you see things, organizations that don't work well. I don't care whether it's a huge corporation or it's a 5-person team. But when you don't have that, full well from your own work, that's one of the first things you've got to fix.
What's interesting, earlier, Charlie, you mentioned that, especially in the industry you were in, the industry I'm in, really anyone where there's an exchange of money or a possible exchange of money. I've even actually seen this in church settings. Things can become very transactional. It's very transactional in that if I do this for you, you either pay me or you do this for me. And everything about the tone that I feel coming from you, and I'm not I don't think we're totally pure that we don't do some things, or we're not okay with someone paying us for things. We definitely are. But everything about the tone of this conversation about the book is anti-transactional, more communal, anti-business about money, more about love and interacting, which to me, I think that's, I've done deep dives into the kingdom of God, and y'all can tell by my language, the contrast between the kingdom of God and the Babylonian system. And this is dollars and cents over here. This is love. And that was the foundation, I believe, of what y'all were projecting, I think, with your book. I've got a couple more quick things before we wrap up. And one was, I wasn't sure if we'd get down this path, but I saw somewhere, Charlie, that you were really utilizing AI, or at least you had some AI interest. I hope I read that right. And and I have too. And I've actually interacted with some Christian groups in the podcasting circles and all that are almost like scared, afraid, whatever. They question things like the integrity of someone that is using it. And as a creator, as someone who I think you call yourself an improvisational creator, what are your thoughts on AI? And we don't have 2 hours here. I wish we did, but you know, in a few minutes, talk about where we are with creating things and doing things with this new tool. I call it a new tool.
Right. Yeah, it is. It is a new tool. Yeah, I would direct people to sort of my introduction and talking about this. They can just look up my own podcast, Music and Meaning, and they'll see an episode on the subject there. But in short, I would say I have an openness to the new technology just because that's the way I'm wired. I do have an openness to things, and I don't make sort of like quick judgments like, oh, that's nonsense, particularly when I see how much people are investing in it and how much it's sort of been like the frog in the pot. I mean, it's been around a long time. And we're already indoctrinated into using a lot of it, right? Whether you call it that or not. I think what's really happened is that people have now woke up to, like, we're actually going to call it artificial intelligence. And before, they were just calling it Siri, right? They're just talking to Siri. And now they know, like, oh, so that's part of this whole artificial intelligence thing. For me, for the music part of it, I'll tell just a very short story. I started out with analog recording, okay, which is analog tape. It's a magnetic process that imprints the sound on this tape, right? So most of anybody who is 60 years and older, who's ever owned a cassette, knows this process, right? Well, then we moved to moving around ones and zeros on a computer, which is the way all music is made today, with very few exceptions. And then we, of course, there's a whole group of baby boomers and Gen Xers out there who listen to CDs, right? And now we just stream. And when you're streaming, you're just streaming the same kind of data that was embedded in a CD. So I tell just a little bit of that to help listeners see that this is just a big potpourri of these interchangeable technologies that we're playing with and mixing up. And now what we have with the possibility with AI from a musical standpoint is I can literally take your MP3, right, that you recorded on your voice memo of your grandchild's birthday party. I can find your grandchild's voice, and you're saying, oh, I just hate that I can't hear her telling us thank you for that birthday gift. Well, I can go in, isolate that voice now, pull it out, raise the volume of it, put it back into the recording, and hand it to Grandpa, and now they've got their grandchild's voice saying, oh, Papa, thank you so much. I love this bicycle. Right? So there's a lot of just small practical ways that the technology of artificial intelligence will be used in helpful ways. It is going to undermine some jobs. Like, I'll give you one example and then we'll just move off of it. But for example, if you're a musician who produces sort of low-hanging fruit music that's underbed music on a TV show, and you're used to getting like $500 to $750 for a 20-second, 30-second clip of music that you can't quite hear, but it's supposed to sound like a rock band from the 1970s, right? You're not going to have a gig anymore. There's going to be one person who just simply uses all this artificial intelligence to produce that music, and they're going to have like VP of AI at ABC Television, right? And they'll have a couple of helpers, and they'll do all the music for that level of music. But it doesn't mean that they're still not going to go license some big song or some new hit song or like that. But it's those little pieces that, like, we use music all the time, but we're not really listening to it. So anything like that is probably going to be replaced by AI and stuff.
And not only that, Andy, I know.
That's my introduction to AI.
I'm using it quite often. And I tell people I'm using it as a brainstorming partner and a writing assistant, because we create quite a bit of content from these, and then we feed it through some tools that we have, and it creates some small content items. And I'm still overseeing it all. It's still part of, but yeah, you know, it kind of brings me to the last question. I'll go with you, Andy, and then we'll wrap up here and talk about how people can find the book. It does at times make me ask, what am I creating for? Who am I creating for? And is something like the writing process more for me, or is it for the person that I'm writing it for? So just kind of, I'm just curious, because obviously, Andy, I told you I loved your writing. I felt as if I was able to really get to know you with that. Who do you write for? Do you write for you? Were you writing for me? Were you writing for someone? What is that as we finish up here?
Yeah, with the beginning of writing for me is that I'm writing out of this deep sense of I have to write. If I don't write somewhere, and that could be in a journal, it could be something that is not meant for somebody else. But in this particular book, obviously, I was writing for the publishing company that we signed to. But prior to that, I had written a lot of these different parts of what ended up being what ended up in the book.
As a letter.
I had written them along the way of my life for a blog that we had, or for a magazine, or for just my own self, kind of because I need to write my way through life as a response to life and to understand what's going on. So it's all that. And it becomes narrowed if I'm writing it definitely for a book, then I don't really know who's going to buy the book. So it's still a place of I'm sitting at my desk and I'm asking God to direct my writing. And then also I'm writing out of a sense of I love to do this. I can't not do this in some form.
I would say, connecting back to the AI conversation, in terms of artistry and the writer's voice, Andy is a perfect example of the writer who should not use AI. In other words, if we're going to have all of this AI doing different things, we want to have Andy Ashworth in the world that we can come back to and say, like, okay, this is just pure writing as self-discovery with the community in mind, and I can come to this writing and receive something that I can't get anywhere else. And so I believe that very strongly, not just for her writing, but for all kinds of artistry. And then just as much as I believe that for you, if you told me, you said, look, I always know that it's, I want 500 words as my introduction, and we have a general way that we do it. So I start with an AI template that I do, and then I start, you know, adapting language from there. I'd be like, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And I,
and there'd be no, like, there'd be no negative judgment. It'd be like who your audience is. You're doing it every week. You want it to have a certain tone. It already has. It's like, why mess with it? You're going to do some plug and play of information, right? And then you're going to add more to it. That's going to be personal and all of that. And that's something that AI can help us do quite well.
And I think the message, part of y'all's message in the book, is there's room for all of that. We don't necessarily, and we do know, here's what we know about a tool like AI. There will be people that abuse it. Every technology that has ever existed, there has been abuse. But we know that we, it's not as if that should surprise us. And so that doesn't mean we're fearful of it or anything like that.
Right.
You brought up something, Charlie, I think in one of the letters that you wrote, and I kind of linked it together with what Andy was just saying. And that is, for me, when I'm purely writing, not writing as a tool for getting information out to a large group of people or different things like that. When I'm purely writing, it is impossible for me to multitask. And multitasking is, I've realized for me, I need to do less of it, even though I think I'm good at it. I don't need to do that as much. I think you even said that, right, Charlie?
My point in the book was that I thought I was really good at it, but you learn after a time that you may be getting one thing really, really good and the other three things you're juggling are approximations. They're good enough. It's because you're highly skilled, right? So they're good enough to get by and they do their work, they do their job, but they don't have that pinnacle of excellence, like the one thing, if you're just sitting down and concentrating.
Yeah, and it's actually one of the reasons why I love what I am doing here and with writing. It's like Charlie and Andy for 60 minutes is my singular focus. And that, I believe, unfortunately, I love what y'all talked about with the art house and other things, that unfortunately, even with all the tools we have to connect with people, we're really connecting with less quality in many ways. So I love that. One of the things I'd love, let's kind of start wrapping here. When I'm reading through this, I'm really wanting to ask the question of two people that have had extremely rich lives, rich careers, again, almost 50 years of marriage. I'm kind of wanting to ask, how are you defining success now? And you did it somewhat in the book, but I'm going to let you verbally tell me, because it could be a little bit different verbally than it is in writing. So Andy, maybe first for you, how are you defining success right now? And then Charlie will jump to you. And then I've got a couple questions we'll wrap up with.
Success for me is, I think when I am at my best, I'm coming back to the fact that I am grateful, I think, that we're together, that we have people who love us, and that we have people to love. I'm grateful that I do get to write, which is a really important thing to me. And it's those kinds of things that make me feel a kind of success that is not a numbers thing. It's not quantifiable. I can't measure it. There's no possibility of measuring. So I think if I leave from this life onto the next life and I really have a central goal, like if my children and my grandchildren know and are sure of that they are deeply loved and that we have loved them and I have loved them. Like, that will be success. That will be a fruitfulness, and or that other people have been felt loved and cared for, and, you know, the relational part of things is in place. That's where I feel fruitful, grateful. And also, I also can't be the one who measures that. So that's kind of like a resting place of, that's kind of great because, yeah.
There's an eternal measurement, not, my wife and I have been focusing on attempting to understand eternity more, knowing full well that we can't. But part of that feeds into that answer. That was a great answer there. Charlie, how about you? How are you defining success now? Or what do you want to say about success?
Yeah, really similar to Andy. I have achieved all of the worlds in my small music world. I've achieved all of the mountaintop awards and experiences that are available. And grateful for those. That's the world standards of success according to business. But I'm also at a point in my maturity is that if I were continue to be driven by those things, I would be a man who hadn't learned anything. And so I'm grateful, but I'm also like Andy, I just want my kids to love and respect me, and my grandkids the same, and I want them all to know how deeply they're loved. And I want to leave my time here and this part of my mission as I leave for the next part. I just want to leave. I don't want to have any enemies. I want to have all amends made. I want to clean up and throw away a lot of stuff that I don't need. I don't want to leave my kids. And mostly, I just want, at the end of the day, I want Andy and my kids and grandkids and everybody who knows me to just say, oh, yeah, no, he was definitely with Jesus.
Yeah.
He was definitely, if there was a Christian, then he definitely was.
I think that's good. And for those of us that attempt to measure things, I'm an engineer by training, and it's like, man, how do we quantify things that are not quantifiable? I think that's the thing that's so fascinating to me. And so that both of the responses, and my wife and I have been through like all couples' ups and downs and things like that. And the thing that we say over and over again is that we wouldn't wish our journey on anyone, but we're so thankful that we've been through it because it's who we are. And it's how you end up with a book like you guys have, Why Everything That Doesn't Matter Matters So Much, The Way of Love in a World of Hurt. Excellent book. Like I said, I rarely recommend books to my wife. I'm recommending this. And it's when I finish it, I've got it on my Kindle right here. I finished it earlier, and my wife will be reading that. So appreciate you writing that.
Thank you so much.
We are Seek, Go, Create, those three words. My final question here before I do a wrap up, seek, go, or create. I'm going to allow you or force you, depending on your personality. And with the two of you, it could be one of you says, oh, he's going to force me. And the other one might say he's going to allow me. I won't tell you which one I think it is, but I'm going to allow you or force you to pick one word, seek, go, or create. Just real quick, which one do you choose and why? And don't overthink it. This is not like a scientific thing. Seek, go, or create. Andy, which one do you choose?
Seek.
And why? Why seek?
It's just my starting place. Seek and then create. And then go, probably in that order.
Very good.
Yeah.
But seek is first. Because I want to know, I want God to, I need to seek first.
Very good. How about you, Charlie?
I think people who know, maybe some of your listeners that know my work would think that I'm going to pick create. but I'm going to pick Seek too. Seek is the starting place for everything.
Mm. I love that.
Seek first the kingdom of God.
And there's a reason that they're in the order that they're in, and y'all could probably guess that. Andy and Charlie, I've enjoyed this so much. The book, again, is Why Everything That Doesn't Matter Matters So Much. And I love the tagline, the way of love in a world of hurt. We need more messages like this. I encourage everyone to get the book. Thanks for listening in. This has been a great conversation. I've enjoyed it. We do have new episodes every Monday here at Seek, Go, Create. And I just encourage you to subscribe, follow, leave reviews, all of those things, because they help us get messages like this out. So again, thanks for listening in. Until next time, continue being all that you were created to be.